welcome to Organized Crime and Punishment, the best spot in town to hang out and talk about history and crime, with your hosts, Steve and Mustache Chris.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Now that we've gone through that whole story with the Molly Maguires, we've gone through so much of it with the Civil War. What was, Joe, what was the aftermath of the Civil War? How did that play out for this group of labor organizers and people and, you know, culture and everything?
So the Civil War, far from it being like this time of like, you know, there's this idea that after the Civil War, the country, everyone got together, all the bad blood was kind of shed already, and only John Wilkes Booth really had a problem with what was going on and his conspirators. It's not really the case. In reality, there were huge violent ramifications throughout the entire nation, not just with the start of Reconstruction. You saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and the Knight Riders in places like the South. And in the Anthracite region, you see serious reaction and hostility. These people, they argued for years that the Constitution should stay the same as it was and the Union should stay the same as it was. That was no longer the case. Everything was turned on its head. And the entire economy basically contracted, not just in America, across the entire planet. I cover Puerto Rico. The economy there completely falls off a cliff because for a long time, Puerto Rico was supplementing the cotton that was not being grown and exported from the United States or the Southern United States. So you see this huge contraction, and it affects these miners specifically, because with the leaving of these federal troops, with the nosedive of needs to market, the entire economy sputters and a bunch of people are left out on the streets. That means that a lot of people turn to highway robbery. They turn to things like bushwhackings of miners and stuff. And they turn to labor unrest. Some of the more moderate of them, I suppose, or the least violent. They turn to labor unrest. They try to start strikes. These strikes are usually not successful. There's a very long one in 1865 where coal executives planned a 33% pay cut. And so to dispatch this, to end this labor unrest, the government dispatches troops like right away, almost immediately following the Civil War, May 1865. So the troops are there. They do such a good job that coal executives come up with a new excuse for another Pennsylvania militia unit to be stationed there the rest of the summer of 1865. In one of the more hilarious newspaper articles of all time, the Lebanon Advertiser is talking about this supposed uprising, and this is very tongue-in-cheek. They say, several thousand have been killed. The Irish are murdering everybody. The country in general, and the streets of Pottsville in particular, are crowded with bloodthirsty miners who kill all but Irishmen. So at this point, a lot of this, I think that goes to show that that newspaper clipping right there, a lot of this, these arguments against labor uprisings have become kind of hashed out, and people are experiencing a general sort of weariness against labor agitation. But the bosses don't seem to mind this. This is how this guy Franklin Gowan comes into the picture. Gowan was, I spoke about him in the first few parts here. He was born an Ulsterman, a Protestant Ulsterman. He was sent to a Catholic college because his father was incredibly, he was for religious tolerance and liberation. And he's brought in as a lawyer for these Cole executives because they need a legal excuse to bring in troops. This starts his involvement in the Cole region, and this starts his involvement with the railroads and with the whole economy in the area in general. And he ends up being one of the biggest players in the story to come. So almost right away, the fury over these troops is pretty substantial. A bunch of people get killed. There's a guy, Peter Monaghan. He's killed in a fight with, Peter Monaghan gets into a fight with this guy, Tom Barrett. Barrett gets thrown in jail and he gets killed by guards, supposedly. Thanks to the military occupation, the strike pretty much peters out. So the miners were saying, we'll accept 10 to 15% pay cut, not the 33. Just let us go back to work. We're all starving. You know, our families are going hungry. Coal executives, they say, no, we're going to see this out to the end. The strike collapses. People begrudgingly go back to work. Families are evicted. They're forced to move. They're forced to go all over the place. In one of the most famous examples, a lot of these people who would consider Molly Maguire's are part of the larger Irish community in Pennsylvania. They actually drift north to Canada, and they take part in the Fenian raids. Chris, I don't know if you want to talk about that. No, it's such a weird, crazy part of history. These were Irish Americans who invaded Canada to protest the treatment of Ireland in the British Empire. It's a hilarious scene. It was something like 400 different, Irish militant nationalists who were full on invading Canada, and both countries had to get together to try and put down this strange movement. It's one of the craziest parts of history. I read about it. I was like, what?
Canada was still under the British Empire at that point.
Mm-hmm. Now that you mention it, we didn't declare our independence until much later. Now that you mention it, I do vaguely remember it. So this kind of reminds, I don't, you guys probably wouldn't know this, but this was like, I think it was like 10 years ago. It was a long time ago. I can't remember. And there were Tamils were protesting what was going on in Sri Lanka, and they shut down a bunch of highways, and people up here in Canada are like, what's going on here? Like, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Like, do you know what? Like, why would a Canadian need to know what's, you know, about the conflict that's going on in Sri Lanka, right? And it's just one of those moments where you go, like, I don't understand why they're shutting down the highways.
Yeah, in this case, it's even more egregious than that. These people are arming themselves, they kill something like 50 British soldiers in the whole war. It's a really crazy thing that happened. And by the end, there's only like 70.
Right? They were hardcore veterans, Civil War veterans, a lot of them. Like, it wasn't just a joke. A couple of mummers walk across the border and start, you know, shooting at people. That was a real thing. And wasn't it initially the U.S. government was kind of like wink, wink? And then, like, they realized they had to get on it.
I'm sure there must have been something like that. Because at the same time,
how'd they allow it to happen?
Yeah, you let 400 armed Irishmen walk across the border. I understand that border security probably wasn't on par as what it is today. But still, that's a pretty egregious thing. I mean, they wouldn't let 400 armed Irishmen, you know, walk down the street in Philadelphia in the same time period.
Well, what made it crazier is that they, I think they staged off of an island in the Niagara River, if I'm not mistaken. So they were allowed enough to, like you say, 400 Irishmen stage in an island. So they had to have had a lot of boats to get there and then a lot of boats to get to the other side. So there must have been somebody who was like, you know, let's take a little pot shot at the British, you know, now that the war's over.
That's hilarious. Yeah, it's such a crazy part of history. And Chris, you wanted to say something?
No, it's just like, I find, like, just from reading a little bit of this story, it's a lot of like, oh, like how, like mistreated the Irish were, and there's a lot of that, right? But you see stuff like this, and say you're like Anglo-Protestant stock, your family's lived here a couple of generations, and you see this and you're just like, we didn't have these problems until do you know what I mean? Like it's understandable where you go, like, is this, I don't know, is this something that we really want? And we're doing a series on like Italian immigration and stuff like that. And when people like Madison Grant was like was a super hardcore racist, right? Like he had like racialist arguments for it, but I could understand a general perspective going like, maybe we can just slow it down.
Yeah. And I mean, you could make the same argument against like American revolutionaries in the 1770s. You're like, what? Cause you're paying too many taxes. What are you talking about? You don't even pay that much compared to the rest of the British Empire. Yeah. I mean, hey, and the same thing in Puerto Rico too. They were like, you can't tax us. How dare you? It was like, but we're just taxing you the same amount that we're taxing everyone else in our country. So it's that strange dichotomy. I mean, it's the upper versus the lower, and that's a constant struggle between the two.
And I think that really applies with the Molly Maguires, because you think about it, after the Civil War, there was a lot of during the war, there was inflation, and so they had to raise and because of all the need for the more coal and more stuff like that. So the wages went up. But then when deflationary pressures come in, wages should naturally go down. So they had to fight to get the wages to go up during the inflationary times. And then, well, now our wages are like this. Who wants to take a cut, even though the macroeconomic situation saying that prices should go down? I mean, we're going through that same thing now. Wages aren't keeping up with inflation, and people want raises to keep up with inflation, but eventually inflation will settle down. And who wants to have their wages go down once they're at a certain level to keep up with that? I mean, that's like classic Keynes and sticky wages, but that it's more than just a theory when it's happening to you. So you can really see how these workers, you know, they're getting basically screwed on both ends of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even today, I mean, I'll talk about this later, the coal mining situation in America. It's a pretty egregious the way the company or the country deals with coal miners. I'm researching right now about the Harlan County Wars in the 1930s in this country. Basically, short story short, miners in Kentucky were trying to unionize. It was resisted violently by coal operators and local police forces. And by the end, we're talking like 2011, the union succeeds, but Barack Obama passes a bunch of environmental legislation to counteract the effects of dirty coal, because coal is the dirtiest beyond anything that you can burn. It's the dirtiest. So there were logical steps taken to prevent coal mining to continue production. But this left the coal miners completely out in the snow. I think there's so much work being done toward marijuana legalization. And the first people who get the first crack at a lot of these marijuana postings or jobs or whatever are people who were formerly incarcerated for marijuana charges. So I think it would be a good idea if when any of this new green legislation comes forward, the first people who really benefit from it should be these coal miners who are completely left in the dark. It's not like their company just has to declare bankruptcy and they can go back, you know, they can go back to their moderately well-off lives. The coal miners completely left in the dark. They're left with no money. And in some cases, they were actually forced to mine for no pay. And they stood on the tracks like these Sri Lankans did in Canada of the railroad, so that the coal that they picked, which was basically using enslaved labor, wouldn't be sent away. They wanted to be paid for the things that they did. And this is the same thing here. I mean, as far as we've come, there's always farther we can go. And this just shows the level of egregiousness that it could be versus where it is now. Not that there aren't problems. I just think I showed one right there. These coal miners who haven't done anything wrong. They're not trying to destroy the planet. They're not trying to raise sea levels. Not actively. They're just trying to bring home food for their kids and family. But because of the situation they find themselves in, they're given the short end of the stick, like you were saying, Stephen. But what do you guys think of that? Do you think that that's a pretty fair assessment with every environmental, you know, Green New Deal, whatever that gets passed? The first people who benefit, I think, should be these coal miners and the people who are getting the short end of the stick in all these cases.
It was like when they did deindustrialization in Canada and the United States. I mean, we can argue whether that was a good idea or not a good idea to switch over to more of a service economy. And I have my own opinions on that. Problem is, like, a lot of the, so when they closed a lot of these factories down, I mean, you can pull up the articles, it's a meme now, but literally a lot of these people thought, like, the people that were working in these factories were going to learn how to use computers, or they're going to be coders, or they were going to do this or that. And, like, yeah, if you're in a think tank and you're talking about people like they're interchangeable, it sounds like a good idea. But the reality is, like, I am assuming a lot of these guys that are working in coal mines, yeah, maybe the managers and stuff like that, slightly different. But the guys that are actually, you know, mining the coal, they're not going to be working on computers and stuff like that. And I mean, in a humane way, you have to find them something else to do. You have to, right? Otherwise, you have what happened in Pittsburgh. You have what happened in all these towns that became deindustrialized. They become hell on earth. I mean, look at Detroit.
It's going to be interesting to see with this trend because, I mean, yeah, it's been since the 70s, and the deindustrialization has hurt really, I mean, I guess you would say more unskilled labor. But now, like, we're getting into ChatGPT and all these things like that. You can write code in ChatGPT that would take 20 coders a week to do, and these AI programs are doing it better in an hour or less. I mean, it's so now that it's creeping into the like the next rung of skilled labor that has not been affected by these trends. I wonder what's going to happen with that. I mean, so many fields are going to be disrupted through AI and things like that, and HR and in accounting, where they're just not going to need people, you know, armies of people. And it's going to be interesting to see when it creeps into to Zoomers getting affected by all of these trends. You know, what's going to happen to that, people who, I mean, arguably, probably for one reason or another, have a lot more voice in society. You know, what's going to happen when they're, I mean, we're starting to see the trends, like job numbers. Most of the increase in jobs has been in the service economy on the lower end of the pay scale. But the number of people who are in the $100,000 job range that are getting laid off, it's like 30%. It's huge.
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely a problem because, I mean, I don't need to tell anyone the historical parallels to the situation that we're in, where people are making or being employed at bad jobs, and they're forced to get more jobs to make ends meet. And either they run to the far left or the far right. There's really no in between. And they the government's sort of forcing the situation on people. And that's really not okay. I think that before anything, more democracy is what's needed in the government and in the workplace and in everyday life. I don't think that there's really a point where democracy can really fail. If everyone has an opinion, everyone should be allowed to express it. That's just me.
Yeah, that definitely opens up a huge discussion. Steve here. We are a member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, featuring great shows like Richard Limbs, This American President, and other great shows. Go to ParthenonPodcast.com to learn more. And here is a quick word from our sponsors.
You guys are talking about AI and, like, you know, like robotics and stuff like that slowly taking away a lot of these jobs. I mean, another repercussion I think people aren't taking into account is physical labor. I'm not talking about the stuff that the time period that we're talking about in terms of the miners, you know, like the black cloth and the horrible working conditions. And I mean, that was not right, obviously, right? It was extremely bad. But physical labor in terms of just, you know, physically working a job, Now, I'm not saying that people have to do this for their entire lives. This is, I don't know, it's kind of basically what I do for work. But I think once that's kind of not there, it's not going to be good, especially for men, to be quite honest with you. I think they should, every man should have to work a physical job at one point in their life just to kind of understand.
Yeah.
If you think you have it bad at your job, you know, it beats throwing coal in the crate and lugging it up a hill. You know, like, it really does. I think it has like kind of a leveling effect. It's either you can do the job or you can't do the job, right? I just think that's something that's, I don't know, people aren't talking about. I don't know, people say it, I don't know, they see it as a liberation, like, oh, I'm liberated from the you know, the toils of hard labor. But a hard labor in and of itself, I think, is a good quality.
And I was thinking too, like, that connects back to the Molly Maguires and like this the conflict between labor and management. Like, think about it, you know, over the past, the deindustrialization of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and even to the 2000s, like, all the people who lost their jobs, are they going to really care that now the managerial class and the coders and the accountants and the HR, that they're losing their jobs now? Like, that class distinction's been set up now, and they're not going to really care, and there's not going to be a lot of room for forming alliances, because they're going to be like, yeah, you made, you know, six figures for all these times while I was, you know, for two generations now, people have had no jobs, you know. So I think a lot of conflict is going to be coming up. And a lot of that conflict really played out in the 1870s, where there was such a massive change in the way the economy worked.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of the 1870s, the thing like the Paris Commune just happened, 1870. The Communards rose in Paris. And something like 20,000 to 100,000 Parisians were butchered in the street by a reactionary French government. And this became the synonymous calling card for all forms of agitation. They blamed the Great Fire in Chicago on Communards. They compared the Sioux Nation, which was fighting their last rebellion in the plains of Dakota and stuff, to the Reds. They were like, these were the first, and that's, it works out that they were literally red men. That's what the at least journalists and everything called them. And they were like, this is red society in America, and we need to stomp this out so Americanism can start to flourish again. And that was how this whole scenario was sort of placed in. And throughout the late 1860s, early 1870s, the Molly Maguires were very active. So there's a guy, David Muir, he's killed. He's shot through the heart and he's stabbed repeatedly. There's this guy, William Pollock. He's on the road with his kid. He gets bushwhacked. He gets shot in the back, but somehow he manages to turn on his attacker. And during their hand-to-hand struggle, his son is just like pummeling this dude over the face with a horsewhip, who's only 14 years old. So good on that kid. He was seemingly raised pretty well, that he was able to defend him and his father in that situation. So following that, there was a period of calm. This is because there were no major peasant holidays in between. So the second December starts up, boom, there's another killing. A company store was ransacked. Philip Warren's, his house was ransacked too. His wife was held at gunpoint, terrorized. 1866, same exact thing. It's more of the same. On April 2nd, two strangers, complete strangers, arrive in Mahoy Township, and they shoot a mine owner's son in the face. This kid, or I assume young adult, I'm not sure how old he was. He manages to stay alive, and he fights off these two, and one of them gets killed in the melee. This shows pretty clearly that Mollies were working across county lines. They would travel north and south across county territory and commit hits based on, you know, what this guy said about this mine operator or what this member said about this company store. And this is how things happened for a lot. So to counteract this, the Pennsylvania state legislature goes to an unprecedented new level. They give private military powers to the coal executives, and they create the coal and iron police. This, as you might expect, was not a very good institution. They mostly targeted people for labor agitation of any kind. I mean, maybe some of the people they arrested were genuinely awful people, and that's definitely possible. But for the most part, a good portion of the people they went for were, you know, community men about town who had a voice, who weren't going to be cowed by, you know, the coal executives and what they wanted. This was compared at the time to feudal retainers. So who I mean, today, who knows what it would have been compared to? I mean, it probably what it would have been compared to is the Wagner Group, which is what we talked about a little bit before. And it goes a step further. The guy, Mark Bullock, he says basically that there was a colonized island in the midst of the Pennsylvania Commonwealth. So they've given up all forms of control. So for months, as these strikes go on, the companies just keep the mines open. They're like, we're going to keep the mines open. We're going to get rid of the worst, and we're going to bring in new people. We're going to bring in people from England and Wales. When they bring in these miners, they're also complaining about, you know, rigorous work schedule, lack of pay, you know, no pay for putting up beams of protection, et cetera, et cetera. And they're like, what's the problem? So eventually the coal operators just go broke. They run out of money. And this sort of opens the door for this guy Gowan to come in. Before he's able to come in and take over everything, a union rises. This is one of the first major mining unions, especially in the state of Pennsylvania. This was the WBA, or the Workmen's Benevolent Association. It was headed by an Irish miner named John Siney. He only recently moved to America. He immigrated from England, born in County Leash. He immigrated to England, and then he immigrated once more to America in 1863. And this was a clear sign that things were changing for the Irish community in Pennsylvania and the country at large. It wasn't just some Irish thing anymore. The WBA was incredible in the fact that it allowed all nationalities to participate. Any kind of person can join this workman's society and receive benefits through it or support. With the rise of the WBA, you see immediately Molly Maguire killings fall off a cliff. In 4 years, there were two. That's almost unheard of. Every other year we've talked about so far, there's been at least 10, if not more, Mali related killings. So what does this say? I think this says, and when we talked earlier in our first part, Chris was asking, what's the point of all this? I don't get it. I don't know what to make of this. I think what to make of it is that when this union came, violence fell off a cliff. And when unions spring up in anywhere across the planet, violence, especially labor-related violence, falls off a cliff. That's not to say there aren't places where corruption can sneak in and organized crime can take over. I mean, my grandfather was a Teamster under Hoffa. So I know full well about the many abuses that could take place when unions are given too much power. But if you treat them as equal equal institutions, equal associations, you see violence fall off a cliff. Any country, you can name it, violence has fallen off dramatically once union rights are preeminent in the state's thinking. Talk about a place like Italy. In the 1890s, the Fasci movement was huge, and they were these violent agitators, much like the Molly Maguire movement. And what happens after they're crushed violently by this guy Crispi, new prime minister comes in. He allows the right to strike. He allows unions the right to organize. He allows collective bargaining. And instantaneously, wages go up, the livelihoods of people go up, and the economy flourishes. Not just flourishes. I'm talking about Italy has the second highest growth rate prior to World War I than Japan. Every other country, it outpaces. It outpaces Great Britain. It outpaces France. Even the United States is not a more powerful economy besides Japan, who's going through the Meiji Restoration at this time. So this to me is the point. I think union rights, when they're introduced, they mitigate violence on a huge scale. But what do you guys think?
Oh, I was going to say, like you brought up, I mean, the problems with the unions. I mean, one
yeah,
big part of our show, really, Organized Crime and Punishment, is talking about organized crime and unions and the corruption that it can breed, right? But at the same time, like if you know you're dealing with, say, characters, say, from the mafia, I'm just going to use this as an example, you're less likely to screw around, are you not? I don't, that's because you don't know who's going to be knocking on your door, right? But in terms of like, say, like the owners and say union reps being able to communicate with one another, better if the unions have a bit more power, I would generally agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not the, I don't know, like I didn't grow up with like the Teamsters Union and stuff like that, right? So like I have like an interesting, I don't know how to feel about unions, because like I hear sometimes, like, you know, somebody joins the union and then I hear what they're getting paid in terms of what he's like, somebody at work mentioned their husband's like a carpenter or something, or he's doing, I don't know, something, he's in the union and they're paying him, I think it's like $70 an hour, and I go, I don't think that's sustainable. You know what I mean? Like, Like, long term, I don't think that wage is sustainable. I know up here in Oshawa, where I currently am right now, there's a big GM plant, and they basically shut the entire plant down for, I believe it was 2 years, to basically get all the old workers out. And then they brought, then they opened it up again, and I think they're making a truck and one other vehicle out of there, and they brought all new workers. And I mean, one of the reasons that they got rid of all the old workers, you had guys that had been working there for, you know, 30 years, right? And literally their job is to, like, say, put the tires on the car when it's going through the assembly line. And some of these guys were making close to $50 an hour. And I go, I don't know, you can't run a profitable plant at those wages.
Only a few dollars. So not more than $3 or $4 a day. And they weren't even paid based on like ratage or wages or anything. They were paid on tonnage. So it depended on how much coal you literally mined. And of course, every single like dynamite charge you used to displace coal, that was taken out of your paycheck. You broke a piece of equipment, that was taken out of your paycheck. Your thing went off on your headlamp, you had to replace that. That's coming out of your paycheck at the end of the week. And this is in the movie. This is one of the best scenes in the entire movie. He's getting his paycheck, and the guy in the nice suit is saying, "You use three things of dynamite. You had to replace a wick on your thing, and you have you had to replace a bunch of boards. Here's 23 cents for the whole week." And that was literally all the money he made. And Richard Harris is just there staring at him like stunned, like, "What are you talking about?" And this was a whole lineup of people that have to just sit there and bear all these expenses that they shouldn't have even been charged. I mean, realistically, this should have come out of the company's paycheck at least. I think that's at least a little bit fair. They're forced to come home with 23 cents or in some cases, owe the place that they work at.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's circumstances like that where you look at it and you go, like, organized labor in terms of fighting against some of these injustices, it makes sense, right? It more so, my commentary is kind of like how modern unions are kind of running, and like I just use the wages as an example, and people, I don't know, people will say, like, push back and say, "Oh, you're like a bootlicker" or something like that. But I think they just think objectively, you know, like you can't, it's not sustainable to be paying a guy, you know, $55 an hour just because he happened to work there for 30 years to put a tire on a car. It's just not, the company can't be profitable. And at the end of the day, like it has to be like a symbiotic relationship, right? It can't be just all about the workers and it can't be all just about the owners. It really has to work together, because if the owners are not making a profit, right, how can they justify keeping the workers and vice versa, right? This is what happened in England with the miners there and Margaret Thatcher, right? People can say whatever they want about Margaret Thatcher, but the coal miners in England at the time, these were not profitable endeavors. They just weren't. And regardless of whether you think what she did was right or not right, you know, I have a lot of respect for her, because she decided on a course of action, she stuck to it, you know? And that's an example of where it becomes way too much in one direction. Really, at the end of the day, and people talked a lot about this throughout history, right? You want to have like a symbiotic relationship, kind of, where like the owners are respecting the workers and the workers are respecting the company.
Yeah, it really boils down to it. When there's an imbalance in the labor market, those people, the workers in those Pennsylvania coal towns, there's nowhere for them to go. It's not like they could pick up and go to the next company. So the company really did have them over the barrel. But then when it, like Chris was saying, when things get out of balance in the other way, and labor has so much power over the companies, then the companies wind up folding because they can't pay those wages. Do those imbalances just have to work them out, and they suck at the time? That it's going to be bad for everybody at some point when labor versus management breaks down, but eventually it's going to work itself out. Like, I think almost we want everything to run smoothly, but sometimes it just doesn't. And I mean, I keep bringing it back to how things now with deindustrialization. Yeah, it's 40 years and it's really crushed, like in a lot of places, two generations. But in the grand scope of things, is 40 years a long time? As far as historical trends go, it's really, really bad for individuals on the micro scale. But in the macro scale, that's just how these things work out.
Yeah, but and that's obviously no consolation for someone who's just working and exactly. Is like, wow, yeah. I have to work three jobs just to get my kids into like a decent school or something, you know. But like you were saying today, huge change in the market. Huge change in the way America makes money. Now we're mostly a service service style economy, where previously we were industrialized. I'm in the process of actually researching vociferously for my 1930s episode. It's going to cover the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And there is exactly like what you were talking about, Steve, where labor is given too much power, not out of, you know, like a shifty sort of double dealing kind of way, but genuinely they were trying to give workers power. But what ended up happening, and FDR readily admitted to this, America became a cartel economy. These unions became cartels, and the companies that served them became sort of like the drug fiends. So the drug fiends would do anything possible to keep the cartels happy, which left the government happy, but this led to the massive recession of 1937, which was a huge deal. I mean, there were questions if FDR was even going to get reelected for his third term. We don't think about it now, but it's a huge part of American history. And there was actually a very well-known sort of report, statistical analysis done. I'm just trying to remember who did it. I think it was UCLA. But this guy basically puts forward the argument that FDR prolonged the Great Depression through his interventionist economic policies. That might be the case. I'm not arguing that that's either here nor there. I'd suggest reading the study because it goes into way more detail than just that. Obviously, there's more than that. He makes a point to point out that toward the end of his presidency, FDR changed his mind on a lot of these things, and a lot of these same ideas were shifted and changed to a more even middle keel sort of place. But basically, what ended up happening is like what I was saying, it became a cartel, and that's obviously not good. But it's obviously not good when, you know, private industry is given complete control over their employer. And I think it helps to explain how organized labor and organized crime weren't actually these strange bedfellows. It actually made perfect sense. Just like how organized crime and law enforcement aren't strange bedfellows, it makes perfect sense. They work with each other constantly. I mean, it's a basic relationship. It can be symbiotic. It can be incredibly detrimental.
Steve here. We are a member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, featuring great shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History podcast and many other great shows. Go over to parthenonpodcast.com to learn more And here is a quick word from our sponsors. You really do lay out, Joe, those two dichotomies of where in the 1870s and in the earlier than that, where these corporations had so much control, and then it swings in the other direction. And I think that you really have to think about, like, hopefully people are looking at these things and trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to stop it from swinging so much? Because then when things do swing to such a degree, that's where, how you were saying earlier, is that people either go to the extreme left or the extreme right or some sort of extreme that doesn't end well for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about balance. It's all about middle ground. I mean, even the argument like, oh, I want a complete socialist economy, I want a complete capitalist economy, those are completely unfeasible structures. You can't, I mean, even when Adam Smith was writing Wealth of Nations, he was writing it right at the start of the Industrial Revolution in England. So he was writing about something that was already passing him by. Same thing with Marx. He was writing about socialism from an early industrialized perspective. He wasn't writing about it in the future where, oh, the AI is going to take over people's jobs. Mm-hmm. He wasn't thinking about this. He was thinking about like sewing machines taking over people's jobs. Yeah. I mean, it's literally this. Yeah.
No, it's the truth, though, right? People, I mean, it's good to read the original thinkers, obviously, right? Like, especially, I don't know, there's like a lot of people that will claim like, oh, I'm a socialist, or, you know, like I'm a fascist or something. You're using like the two extreme rights. And then you talk to these people and I'm like, have you actually read Benito Mussolini's book? Like, did you actually read Karl Marx? I know for sure a lot of the times they're lying, because if you actually tried to sit and read Das Kapital, God bless you. I've tried. I got through some of it, but it's not a fun read at all.
So Joe, now that we're moving into the 1870s, tell us a little bit more what was going on at that time.
So through the whole early 1870s, you have this guy, Franklin Gowan. He's buying up everything. He's buying up the canal, which was the main exporter of coal previous to this. He's already been placed in charge of the Reading, Pennsylvania Railroad, and he's starting the process of buying out the legislature. Super easy to do, you know, no problem. That this isn't the issue he's having. The issues he's having is with the union, the WBA, which is now basically a statewide institution, has a lot of power, has a lot of, I guess, progressive congressmen who are on their side, pro-labor congressmen, whatever you want to call them. And he's buying up all this stuff. He's also trying to buy up all these individually owned small businesses. But right before the 1870s, I should just mention this, there's this massive disaster, massive mining disaster. For the time, it was the deadliest in United States history. It's in 1869 at a place called Avondale in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania. 110 miners were trapped when a single shaft mine collapsed on them. They basically suffocated in the collapse. Like, whole townships came to try and save the people still inside, but there was no hope. Right before that, there was actually a safety bill in Pennsylvania state legislature that would have demanded a second exit to your mine. It would have demanded a safety instructor for your mine. It would have, another one would have demanded a fencing around an empty hole, for example. All of these were rejected by the state legislature. The guy who rejected it is this guy, Samuel G. Turner, who said, I can't only remember but one instance where fire damp explosion has hurt a single miner. So because he can only remember the one time when it happened, he decided to vote against this bill. Basically, his words are recounted. His life is in danger. And he ends up passing a safety bill through the House. He loses right away. So at least democracy works a little bit, I guess. At this time, the Mollies are basically underground. I mean, they're letting the Union do their thing. Their main face is the Ancient Order of Hibernians. So that's what they're mainly doing. They're helping out Irish people in town. They're helping out you know, Irish people in local politics, because the Irish, they latch on to local politics very easily. I mean, they become sheriffs, they become mayors, they become, you know, state senators, et cetera, et cetera. And they have a huge avid base because Irishmen will always vote for fellow Irishmen almost exclusively. Even this guy, Gowan, he's voted for exclusively by Irishmen during the Civil War. So 1870, Gowan, he's forced to sign a contract with the Union because rail unions are striking or threatening to strike in solidarity with the WBA. He signs another one in 1871. But in the North anthracite fields, they're still under control of separate mining institutions. And these mining institutions are saying we're going to need to cut wages. So they strike against John Sinise's wishes. It was very effective, but this is when Gowan puts the hammer down. He raises freight rates 100%. He closes down the canal he just bought. And he starts buying up even more territory with these dummy companies. By the end of 1874, he has 100,000 acres of prime coal mining real estate. And this was basically in a single movement, he became like the kingpin. And this basically crushes the strike. They agree to arbitration and they all begrudgingly returns to work. So by 1873, Gowan is meeting with, he meets with Alan Pinkerton. I assume everyone knows the Pinkertons, famous private detective agency. He's famously also, this guy, Alan Pinkerton, he delivered information to the Union on like military movements. He claimed that like the Confederate army was like 200,000 strong outside of Richmond. And this is what made George McClellan pee his pants and run as fast as he could away from there. But he's like this incredibly conservative, like tough on crime. Like he would visibly shake when he heard about certain crimes. Like if he heard about like a really bad break-in or something, he would become visibly angry and like red in the face. He was a real like crusader. He hears about this from Gowan almost right away. He's like, yes, let's stop this movement. We need to end it where it is right now before it gets even worse. He fingers one of his detectives, a guy named James McParland. This guy is an Irish Catholic from Ulster. So he fits the part perfectly. And his job is to go undercover into Schuylkill County, infiltrate the Molly Maguire movement, report on any crimes or anything committed. And through this investigation, he will end up bringing down the Molly Maguires. So he arrives in October 27th, 1873. He showed up. He said he was an itinerant Irish worker. He was just on the lam and he was accused of murder. He supposedly got into a fight with this guy. And that was his cover story. He's almost discovered like right away. The second he shows up in Schuylkill, he's almost discovered by a barman who I assume knew him from, you know, time previous. But he gets off scot-free there. He meets up with the bodymaster of, I forget what county it is, but he meets up with this guy Lawler, who makes him a part of the HOA and then the Molly Maguire movement. He is then made the note taker because he can read and write. No one seemed to question this. They just were like, okay, you can read and write. Sure. Take all the notes. This made it incredibly easy for him to, you know, dig up dirt and keep track of everything that was going on. And it made him an integral part of every meeting. I mean, he was there when they decided when to give out blood money for a hit and when to do this and to do that. And he kept notes on all this stuff. Now, he wrote a book following this, actually, about the whole situation. Now, a lot of people claim he was actually like an agent provocateur, like he was working to sully the good name of the HOA and the Molly Maguire movement, which previous to this genuinely wasn't very violent anymore. I mean, this was they put on their public face, and the Molly Maguires was, you know, something they brought out if they really needed to threaten someone. But through this whole time, they weren't really necessary, the Molly Maguires.
I don't know. What's your opinion? Was he there to be an agent provocateur, or was he just legitimately investigating what was going on?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that it was this and that. I don't think that there was one clear answer there. Because, I mean, if you look at a picture of this guy, he's like, he is steely, determined stare. He seems like the kind of guy. I mean, I don't know him personally, but he seems like the kind of guy to go to any length to advance his station. And this is sort of how he's portrayed by Richard Harris in the movie. He's this guy who will go to any length to just get a little bit ahead because he's been stepped on his whole life. And that's sort of what he looks like genuinely. And just following the Molly Maguires, he would use the same archetype to bring down other movements. Like he's made, in the early 1900s, he's made the head investigator for this bombing in Nebraska, I think. And he uses this bombing of this disgruntled employee against his boss, to pin it on the entire International Workers of the World movement, the IWW. And he accuses the head of the IWW as a part of this conspiracy. He accuses, you know, it's the same, you know, strategy, basically. There's this labor movement that's radical. It's sometimes violent. So he went in, he accused them of this and that. In that case, it didn't work. All the people accused got off. But in this case, it works to the nines. And that's because of how violent things become following the long strike of the 1870s. So this strike lasts like 5 months. It's a 5 month long strike. Throughout it, I mean, people get more and more disheartened as time goes on. And the strike is basically brought on by Gowan. He's been hoarding coal this whole time, even though he owes tens of millions of dollars to, you know, loaners and banks and stuff for all the land he's purchased. He's been hoarding coal this whole time, and this is the final nail on the coffin for the WBA. The WBA, it falls into lesser hands. It falls into the second in command of the movement because John Sine is elected the head of the first president of a national miners union, which represented all miners at the time, or at least attempted to. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean there was other corners on the market that had happened at roughly that time. Was it Gould and Fisk with gold at more or less that time? Like that was a going
yes concern. Yes, that's around that same time. Yeah.
You know, and it was almost like a game of chicken with themselves to if they can do it, like if they can hold off everybody long enough to make it work at the end before everything like just colossally blew up in their face.
Yeah, it was basically a very long game. What'd you say? A game of chicken? That's perfect. It was like who's gonna flinch first? Who's gonna let slip their hand? Who's gonna give it all up? You know, I think that's a very good analogy.
I think it's interesting too with that guy who's basically going undercover. It's different when it's being done, I think, by the companies and through this private company of the Pinkertons. They have a different goal at the end of the day than say the police or the FBI. The FBI has to do things in a certain way with like Joe Pistone that you need to get convictions at the end, and the way that gather evidence throughout that process is going to, we're really at the goal of the companies is just to end the strikes so they can operate in a different way. So like is he an agent provocateur or is he not? It's kind of the same, different sides of the same coin, I would think. What do you think of that?
Yeah, which side are you on? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. If you're on the side of the company, it makes perfect sense for this guy to be going through. And he's doing the Lord's work. I mean, these people agreed to work for this amount of money, for this amount of tonnage rate. And now they're trying to go against an agreement that was made between a company and an individual. I guess from their perspective, they would say, well, this agreement was made under duress, if anything. I mean, we have just as much a right to associate with ourselves as you have a right to decide coal prices for the whole market or gas prices or whatever.
Yeah, and you make an agreement. Does that agreement last forever that we have to basically take it? You know, I think that's the next step to it.
Probably the most bizarre thing for anyone listening to this podcast or researching this is just all these private entities doing all this stuff. Like, it's a private detective company that's doing this, and the company has its own private police force. And it's, you know what I mean? Like, the company's like, it's, I mean, we just don't, I mean, we're starting to see that a little bit offline. We talked to me, I think I mentioned Blackwater, and we mentioned like the Wagner Group, which was like, I don't know, like these semi-private armies. I mean, I think it's something that we're going to start seeing a little more often, probably not within our lifetimes, like Amazon having like an army or something like that. But
we're seeing kind of shadows of that with private security. There's a company, and I can't think of the name of it, and I probably don't want to say it to get on the wrong side of them, but the government is even using them as security instead of police, because police have to do things a certain way. You know, they can't violate your rights completely openly, where these companies, even though they're working for the government, it's kind of like a layer, because these companies are working for the government, they're supposed to follow the rules in a certain way of, like, you know, not trampling on people's constitutional rights. But because they're a private company, you have to sue the company. And then if you have to, like, go through the company before you can sue the government. A lot of companies are starting to use these companies because it insulates them from a lot of liability, and the company is insulated. It's, you know, it's not full blown, where the private security is basically the police for a county like Carbon County or Lucerne County. But you can definitely see that there's some similarities. History isn't repeating itself, but it's singing a similar tune. So what happens as we get to pretty much the end of the Molly Maguires?
So the long strike's over. It is 1875. It's been defeated. Everyone goes back to work. They have to accept whatever Gowan agrees to pay them. People are blacklisted. You have two choices now. You leave, change your name, or you starve. I mean, those are really the two options in front of people. In the 2 months after the long strike, there are 6 Molly Maguire assassinations. So, I mean, if this isn't a clear example of we've lost, you know, the little bit we were given, or we were allowed, we had to take. Now we have to go back to the old ways. We have to go back to the hard men who wait in the night. And this is one of the, I think this illustrates the point perfectly. This was a notice left on a mine shaft or something. And it's written in Irish brogue. So it says, "I am against shooting as much as ye are, but the union is broke up, and we have got nothing to defend ourselves with but our revolvers. And if we don't use them, we shall have to work for 50 cents a day." So this was a very stark choice for the people who were living there. I mean, they're living in this is supposedly new world where you know, things were supposed to be different, where, you know, we fought to make men holy. Now we're fighting to make men free. That's supposed to have happened already. And now they're subjecting people to basically the amount of money you would pay to refurbish tools or something. I mean, 50 cents is nothing. On top of this, there was anti-Irish mob violence as well. So you see vigilantism and start to creep back into the Irish community, where Protestant Irish people or different ethnicities altogether are actively, violently attacking Irish people. In the worst case, Jack Kehoe, who is the new head of the Molly Maguires, is brother-in-law is murdered. He's shot 15 times, dragged out of his house, shot 15 times. His sister is murdered as she's pregnant. She has a baby. She's shot in the chest. And his wife, his mother-in-law is pistol whipped. So she, I guess, got off relatively scot-free. But this was a really horrifying event. In the movie, it's basically tame what happens. I mean, they're both asleep, and they both get shot while they're sleeping. And the baby already exists. in this, the baby is still inside the sister. So the Mollies and the AOH, they begin to fall apart after this. This was the last act of violence that we can point toward or against the Mollies before the situation just becomes impossible. And this has to do with McParland. He returns from exile, from being undercover for 3+ years, collecting all this evidence, and charges are brought toward plenty of people. I mean, 20+ people are charged with connection to the Molly movement or conspiracy to commit murder. Gowen actually serves as the lead prosecutor. So this was at a time when you could still serve as a prosecuting attorney, even if you were a private citizen. And he says during this trial, this really sham of a trial, I mean, it was packed with conservative Dutchmen and Quakers from different parts of Pennsylvania. He says, "This very organization that we are now for the first time exposing to the light of day has hung like a pall over the people of this country. Behind it stalk darkness and despair, brooding like grim shadows over the desolated hearth and the ruined home. And throughout the length and breadth of this fair land was heard the voice of wailing and lamentation. Nor is it alone those whose names that I have mentioned, but it is hundreds of unknown victims whose bones lie moldering over the face of this country." So this was a very like powerful statement. I mean, his whole like diatribe was actually turned into a very popular pamphlet following this, Gowen's diatribe, because it is very much fire and brimstone, you know. Like Chris was saying, you can't help but think that he's kind of cool, right? I mean, I'm doing one about I just did an episode on Blair Mountain, and there's this guy during the Battle of Blair Mountain. This is the largest labor uprising in American history. This guy Don Chaffin, he's the sheriff slash medieval baron of this county in West Virginia. And he is the single worst human being I think I've ever read about. I mean, racist, violent, a drunk, everything that you can think of, this guy is. But you can't help but be like, God damn it, you're kind of cool. I don't like that. I don't like that that's the case. But just for example, this guy, a miner, walks into his office, pulls a gun on him. He says, "Don Chaffin, I'm going to shoot you dead." And Don Chaffin, he pulls out his own pistol, cool as anything. And he says, "Go ahead, we'll hop into hell together." Like, this is the kind of guy that's cool. I can't help it. I'm sorry. But this is the kind of guy that Gowen is too. They share a lot of similarities. So the first, they're all found guilty, obviously. There's no question. It takes like 20 minutes for the jury to deliberate. The first round of hangings is set for, the day of the rope. This is Black Thursday, June 21st, 1877. 10 Molly Maguires, supposed Molly Maguires. A lot of these were just AOH members and union guys and stuff. They all hang together. Among their number is not Kehoe. Kehoe hangs individually. He is charged with an age-old murder that happened like during the Civil War or something. That was like a bar fight that ended in someone getting like stabbed to death or something. But he was charged with this in connection with being the head of the Molly Maguire movement. He tries to argue for years against his hanging. It doesn't work. He gets killed in 1878. And there are about 10 more following that. Two of the worst were these two guys. They were both accused Mollies. They had their sentences reprieved for, I don't know, like a day or a few months or whatever by the governor at like 10:37. At 10:35, they were led to the gallows. So there's this time in between where this messenger is furiously banging on the door to try and be let in before this execution can happen. And basically, they hear this guy banging. They assume it's a distraught relative who missed the time, you know. And they don't answer it until they already are dropped. And so these two people are hanging, twitching because both of their necks don't break. So they're both twitching on the end of a line like fish. And as they finally let this messenger in, and the sheriff reads it, and instead of cutting them down, he takes his time. He's reading the whole thing out. He's like, I just received this. And then the guy stopped twitching. He turned over. He's like, I'm as sorry as anyone. And then he blames the priest. He blamed the priest for speeding up the execution process. So that was a pretty horrifying end to the Molly Maguire movement. So as this is happening, all these Mollies are being executed together. The entire country is in a state of upheaval, the likes of which has never been seen before. I mean, this is the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. Something like 100 plus workers are killed, and they're in a lot of these industrialized places where what we talked about today. Pittsburgh is a huge spot for revolutionary violence during 1877, to the point where like a National Guard unit is like literally barricaded inside a big, like, I think it's like a train station or something, like a big brick train station building. And protesters actually like wheel a burning a wagon full of stuff. So it catches this whole building on fire, and the National Guard need to run for their lives as they're getting shot at by the citizenry of Pittsburgh. In Chicago, there's a burgeoning socialist movement, an American socialist movement, that's led almost exclusively by immigrants, German immigrants, but it's also led by one of the most interesting couples in history. This was the couple of Albert and Lucy Parsons. Albert Parsons was a Civil War veteran. He fought for the Confederacy. So following the Confederacy, he disowned the whole idea. He disowned racism. He became a radical Republican, and then he became an anarchist socialist. His wife was a formerly enslaved woman named Lucy Parsons, who was maybe more radical than he was. And these two basically foment a gigantic uprising in Chicago that kills maybe like 40 people. There's this massive battle called the Battle of the Viaduct between state and civilian forces with sticks and stones and all kinds of weaponry. And in St. Louis, the first ever commune in American history is declared, maybe the only one. This was started during the first general strike in the United States, and it was held up and mostly kept alive through German immigration. And German immigration was a huge part of keeping a place like Missouri a part of the Union during the Civil War. You don't think about it, but Germans, for whatever reason, they said, we need a place that looks exactly like home, and it's exactly in the middle. So they all moved to Missouri, and they were like, this is the same. And that's why the Midwest has so many breweries and stuff, because of this German influence. But yeah, the Molly Maguires, 20 of them would be dead in total. In a final like quotation, this is sort of what you were talking about before, Chris, with the private influence. And it just reminded me of this quote. I needed to find it. So the Molly Maguire trials were a surrender of state sovereignty. A private corporation initiated the investigation through a private detective agency. A private police force arrested the alleged offenders, and private attorneys for the coal companies prosecuted them. The state provided only the courtroom and the gallows. Any objective study of the tenure of the times and the entire record must conclude that the Mollies did not have a fair and impartial jury. They were therefore denied one of the most fundamental rights that William Penn guaranteed to all Pennsylvania's citizens. And as if to emphasize this point even clearer, one of the most famous final events, or final acts, I suppose, of anyone occurs before he's hung. Alexander Campbell, or maybe a guy named Tom Fisher. I'm not sure exactly who did it. There's a bunch of controversy over who was actually the one who did this. But he dug his hand high above his cell wall, and he said, there is proof of my words. That mark of mine will never be wiped out. There it will remain forever to shame the country that is hanging an innocent man. And as far as we know, that handprint is still there. A sheriff eventually, or a warden or something, eventually plastered over the handprint. But it was very visible well until the 1920s, 1930s, when it was finally plastered.
I can attest I've seen the hand. The hand, I don't know if this is, I've gone to that jail. It's a museum now, private museum, and he's the curator. And I talked to him for like an hour because I think everybody else was kind of on the ghost tour. And he was like, anybody who wanted to hear the history, you better take a seat because he was going to tell it to you. The hand came back. And wow. So you can take that for what it's worth, but they plastered over it like plaster, not just painted over it. They plastered over it, and anything that they did, the hand. And I guess the Catholic Church, either they investigated it or they're still investigating it, that it's like a bona fide miracle, like relic type thing.
Wow. So this guy might be Patrick Campbell. He might be on the way to canonization.
Yeah, you can go to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, and see the hand to this day.
Yeah, this is definitely the thing that got me most interested in the story, because I had no idea that this even existed. It's a really terrible reality show, I guess. It's like a ghost hunter show. It's called Ghost Adventures, and there's this guy, Zach Bagan, who's just this complete meathead. I mean, he's like, bro, are there ghosts in here, bro? Are there ghosts? Like, this is how he, like, confronts these ghosts. I'm like, yeah, no wonder nothing has ever happened on one of your shows. But that's how I first heard about it. I didn't understand the labor context behind it. But then once I started researching it, I was like, oh, my God, that's this. And oh, my. But, yeah, it's an incredible story.
I definitely suggest people go to visit that museum, because the curator, and I wish I could remember his name, he will take the time to discuss it with you. And he was great with kids, like very personal one-on-one. And the town of Jim Thorpe is amazing. It's really like a little jewel inside of Pennsylvania. You can learn so much about all of this if you go.
Yeah, I guess one last thing I would like to ask is, so the Molly Maguires, this is kind of the impression that I get, is I'm pretty sure like the Ancient Order of Hibernia and the labor union, they knew that this was like kind of like a group that they could use if they needed to. So it's kind of like this the logic of like you guys have brought it up, like the extreme left and the extreme right, where on both sides of the spectrum, they all have this talking point. Is like, you don't punch left or you don't punch right. Do you understand where I'm going here with this? Where these guys were useful when you needed them. The problem is they weren't. A lot of the times they would cause more problems than they were worth sometimes. So you'd have to find ways to be able to clamp down on them. But you didn't want to get rid of them completely because they're willing to do things that, say, other people aren't willing to do. Would that be, am I far off in thinking that? That's the impression I get.
Steve here again with a quick word from our sponsors.
I don't think so at all. Yeah, you're 100% spot on. And I think it goes even further than that. I think the Union and the AOH and the Molly Maguires, they were all the same people. Maybe not in the same level or the same numbers, but the Molly Maguires were AOH, and the AOH definitely had union members as part of it too. So it's like a big giant circle, and it was an alliance of necessity. I doubt that this progressive labor union really wanted to work with this weird racist localist thing that the Molly Maguires were. But they did it nonetheless, just like labor unions have done throughout history with organized crime or syndicates or just street gangs in general. I mean, throughout this whole period in places like New York City, you saw like street gangs vying for like the highest bidder, and they would show up on the strike day, either supporting or being against the union, depending on who had the most money, if it was the companies or if it was the union heads, or if you had a rival gang, they would join the other side at a little less of a rate so that they could get in on the fight that was about to happen. So this isn't it wasn't like a conspiracy or some sort of nefarious thing that was unintentional, if they don't listen to us, we're going to send this guy in blackface to his house and he's going to blow his head off. I don't think it was like that. I think it was, they were all the same. It was all one and the same. And I think Irish people realized toward the second and toward the second half of the 1860s and the early 1870s that they got farther with unions, with unionizing and with local politics than they did with shooting people in the face. And that seems to, I mean, no matter how right or wrong you thought they were, it wasn't going to work for them doing that policy. And that's just for anything. I mean, no matter how right your opinion is or wrong your opinion is, if you use violence to justify it, no matter how much violence is used against you or your people, it's not going to get anywhere, especially not in a society like we have, where the rule of law, you know, regardless on how much it changes or how much it varies from person to person, it still is applicable and people still believe in it. And until that happens, then outward violence like this is not going to get you anywhere, especially in a place toward more rights.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, you can use examples where the violence works, but in this particular circumstance, like exactly what you pointed out, like people have a sense of the rule of law. It's just not going to work. I mean, you can use, say, Russia as an example, like on the socialist revolution, the communist revolution. I mean, the violence obviously worked in that circumstance, right? But that was a failed state for the most part, where, I mean, they didn't even really have a tradition of rule of law.
I think, though, that like the rule of law, like this idea that the U.S. has been such a paragon of the rule of law, the rule of law entirely failed in this situation, because the miners and the corporations and the private police services would have never have been able to do half of what they had done if the sheriffs of those towns and the counties, if they had just, they allowed it all to happen.
And I mean, it also makes, people wonder why, like, Teddy Roosevelt went so hard against, like, say, the robber barons or whatever words you want to use for them, right? I mean, he saw this stuff, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you see, like, there's literally a private company that's prosecuting miners. You know, did murders happen? Yeah. Were they?
Yeah, at least that guy.
The ones that they, that the state, well, it's not even the state, the private company claimed that they did. I don't know. It's a little bit up in the air whether they did or not. I mean, the handprint seems to show that they didn't. But it does make sense, like later on when they, you know, they start implementing antitrust laws and are worried about these giant corporate monopolies effectively taking over the legal, like taking over the country, really. The opposite end of the spectrum is, you mentioned the Teamsters Union early in the podcast. I mean, that was really the government's biggest concern with the Teamsters Union. It was so powerful and it had so much influence in terms of transportation in the country. They really could have shut down the country if they wanted to easily. And that's not good. It's just not, you just can't have it. Because it takes like a couple nefarious characters, you know, maybe with a communistic type bent to get into leadership roles in a union like that. And all of a sudden you're having a full blown revolution happening, which was a concern still at the time. Right.
And even with like something like the Teamsters, I would not even worry about like a communist taking over. It'd be more dangerous if one of these super corrupt, you know, I guess conservative union bosses took over. I mean, this is what happened to the IBT. Literally, there were numerous like back-to-back leaders who were just completely corrupt and stealing from the workers that they were supposed to be the leaders of. I mean, it really disgusting, horrible stuff that these union heads were involved in, especially part of the Teamsters Union. But I guess on the other hand, if you were a Teamster, you would say, hey, this guy is about as crooked as Nixon. I mean, what's the difference? That's probably what a Teamster would say.
I think there's something naturally baked into unions as well, is that because they're representing the interests, the divergent interest. I mean, basically, if you have a union, every single worker, they don't really have a united, they have a theoretical united interest, but really each worker has their own individual wants and needs. And the union bosses have to put all those individual needs together to get a corporate need out of all of those, corporate in the sense of a need, a vision that encapsulates all of those needs. But in that, individuals are going to get what they want in some ways, and they're not going to get what they want. I mean, I worked for unions for 15 years, and in those negotiations, sometimes it's like, what is this union even doing for me? Because I'm getting shafted on this personally, because my own section, we were small, and the union had to give in something to make the bigger deal go through. And so they had to give in on some of our individual interests to get the bigger plan through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a deal with the devil either way. I mean, however you want to do it. But for me, at least, I think union rights are preferable to any other sort of even like a company union. That those haven't particularly worked very well for the people who've been a part of them, especially when it comes to when the rubber meets the road and it's time to argue. It's time to really stand up for the people you represent. That sometimes just doesn't happen. And it sounds like that's what happened with you there, Steve.
Yeah, I think with the unions, it really depends on the circumstance. Like if you are in a job and in a geography where there's a really fluid labor market, where if it sucks, you can jump over to the next company, then the union is really not your friend. But if you're in a situation where your job isn't fluid and the geography doesn't lend itself to being able to move freely from one job, either it's because of the nature of your work or the industry or whatever, then unions are helpful for you.
It's such an American way of looking at work too, though. Like, just the way you're describing, it's like, oh, I'll just move to another state, or I'll just get to move to another job, right? But I mean, like, you say you live in a place like Romania or Hungary, that's just not, you just can't do it. Like, there's not, where are you going to move? I mean, I guess you could move to another country, but then there's like a whole process and it's a different language. And I just thought of that, right? Like, I don't know, it's just something. It's the same up here in Canada too, right? People are like, oh, I'm just going to, up here, it's always like, I'm going to move further to up like north to get Nebraska. Away from the city. Progressively, just like further up north. It's like the equivalent of you guys, like, I don't know, Gaia, yeah, or something, right? It's the equivalent, right? Like, I'm just going to keep on going up north. And I mean, and by just, you know, but we're massive countries, right? So that's, it's very easy to just move around, right? And you're in a totally different circumstance, or say something like smaller country like Hungary or Romania, it's not as quite as easy.
Well, I think too that in the US and in probably maybe in the West in general, there was never this idea that, like in a lot of companies, like in Japan and Korea, where the company had loyalty to the workers, and the workers therefore had, you know, there was a loyalty between the two. If we hired you, you're going to be treated fairly. And that made the workers feel loyal to the company, where you have company men who work for the company for 40 years. And that is not a Western ideal, I don't think. I think that the much more corporate mindset, again, using corporate in the group sense, that I owe fealty to you and you show fealty to me, maybe more of the feudal thing that really died in the Enlightenment with individuality that just does not exist in modern Western societies.
I mean, that's a perfect example. I was going to bring up the chain of being. I mean, me and you offline have talked about this many times. In terms of the employee-worker type of relationship, you know, obviously there's problems with it. But if there's an understanding that the bosses have certain obligations and duties to the workers, and the workers have an understanding that there's certain obligations and duties to their boss, and it's like a chain, right? That keeps them, goes further and further and further down. And I know it's not popular to look at, say, pre-Enlightenment thinking, but I think there's, in terms of running like a healthy community or a healthy society, it's really not a bad way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. But it's almost next to impossible for even people to kind of think that way, because we grew, our country was literally found, both of our countries were literally founded on Enlightenment ideas. And it's very difficult to think outside of that context. It's very difficult to think outside of the Enlightenment. And people think like, well, like, you're talking about like medieval thought in terms of like having better labor relations. And it's like, yeah, I am legitimately saying that. And I don't know, people think it's crazy, but it's really not. There's a lot of thinkers, especially, I guess you call them like neo-reactionary type thinkers. But if you look at stuff like, I believe it's called the NRX, Nick Land, and some of these guys, they talk about this, the chain of being, and applying some medieval type thought to the modern world. I don't know if your audience is actually interested. They're interesting. They're controversial type thinkers, obviously, right? They're going to ruffle some feathers, but they're definitely worth reading.
I think, and I had another thing to just throw in the mix there is how, and especially Joe, since you've dug so much into this, how do you think this applies to today? Can we use the Molly Maguires as a learning tool for what's going on today? Or is it really so different that there really is no way to apply it?
I think that the only way you look at history is with a modern lens. So I think, yes, that this is definitely a relevant story to today. This shows the absolute extent of how bad it can be when people either don't care or are forced into doing something against their will and against their benefit, and for the benefit exclusively of a nameless million-dollar institution. I think when you look at things like today, there's a massive push against things. We talked about AI today, against AI, and especially you look at the actors' equity strike, or that's happening right now, the Writers Guild strike that's happening right now. They're arguing for the same stuff. They want better pay, they want better conditions, and they want to know that their jobs are going to be protected against AI, which can easily be turned into whatever number of thing you wanted to. Back then, they wouldn't use AI. They would use imported workers, or they would spring one group against the other using religion or ethnicity, anything like this. But this is what could happen if things are regressed to this point, not just to this point. But it could devolve to this in a very easy way, I think. Violence is very much a part of not just Irish history, but American history. And I think this helps explain at least a part of the violence that both have experienced, because whether they were in America or they were in Great Britain, Irish people were treated generally the same for a very long time. I mean, even the idea of Irish people being white is a relatively new concept. Even the idea of whiteness is a new concept, or blackness. These are all new terms that are just another a further division point that we have to get over. Before, you would be a Polak, or you would be a Bohem, or a Johnny, or a Limey, or something. These are the words that they were used, or I would have been like I would have been a Dago. Me and Steve, we would have been Dagos. So I think this goes to show how not only close this is to us, but how the government and corporations at large seem to when you have a job that is very important to the way the country functions, like for example, a coal miner. Who literally generates energy every single day. I mean, how many people can literally say they generate energy? Maybe if you have like solar power or something, then you could say you generate a little bit of energy. But coal miners would generate tons of coal energy every single day. And they were treated like some of the worst workers, even in things like media. They're not represented. I mean, how many coal mining movies can you seriously name right now? I've just watched the Molly Maguires, but that's maybe the only one. And that that seriously goes in depth on how coal mining operates. Besides that, I can't really think. I mean, most of the time, think of like something like the Old West. We talked about that a little bit. You know, there's cowboy movies, there's farmer movies, there's movies about desperados and pistoleros and everything. But there's no real portrayals in today's media. This totally important job, this all-encompassing job that literally created the United States as we know it today. And I've always personally just felt at home with Ireland. I've always really loved Ireland. I am myself Sicilian and Puerto Rican. So my being is of two islands that are still under the thumb of some superior force. But Ireland, at least for the most part, has been rid of British yoke for 100 plus years now. And that, I think, is impressive. It goes to show the perseverance of the Irish people, the way they've managed to, you know, flex their culture into such ways to make life even bearable is pretty impressive. And it's something that it shouldn't be discounted or overlooked, or, you know, Irish people shouldn't just be considered when they first or immigrated here as just like, you know, subhuman, you know, cause even after, this period in Ireland for a long time, the Irish were considered basically subhuman. People couldn't understand how the literacy rates were so low in Ireland as compared to the rest of Western Europe. But what happened? They were given freedom. They were given the right to choose their own destiny and the right to argue for themselves. And that image quickly rebounded. They became the Celtic Tiger when they were given their independence because their economy was so fluid and so powerful. And they dispelled almost immediately all these insinuations about their, you know, proneness to violence and their intellectual level and literacy rates and stuff. These all went away basically overnight when they were truly given, you know, self-determination. And that word can mean a lot to a lot of different people. It just goes to show how much we have to juggle. We have to juggle these things. We have to juggle all this together. It's not just one thing, and it's not just the other. It's about everything. And it's not just about everything. It's about nothing, which is sort of what the Molly Maguires are about. I related to you the Hindu proverb at the beginning of our talk here. And I think it's just perfect. It's all the things and none of the things at the same time, but it's not the things.
I want to, speaking of labor management relations, I got called into work today. So I think we're going to wrap it up this whole series. I want to thank Joe. He's a friend of mine. He's a friend of ours now. Thank you so much for coming on the show. You know, just to reiterate, how can people find your podcast?
So my podcast is available wherever good podcasts are downloaded. If you download it on Spotify, each episode has its own individual series art, which my partner Melissa meticulously does. It makes it look very nice. It's very clean. But yeah, it's Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts.
So look for Turning Tides History Podcast everywhere where you can find podcasts. Thanks again to Mustache Chris, who joined us in this series. We will definitely be hearing if he's willing to come back on. I hope that Joe will come back on again, because this is a great series right here, and I know there'll be more.
I'm glad you guys appreciated it. Yeah, it's a fun little part of history that not a lot of people know about, but I think it's pretty important to explain the sort of world we live in.
If you enjoyed what you hear and you want to spread the message, tell your friends about us so that your friends can become friends of ours.
Oh, forget about it, guys.
Forget about it.
You've been listening to Organized Crime and Punishment, a history and crime podcast. To learn more about what you heard today, find links to social media and how to support the show, go to our website, atozhistorypage.com. Become a friend of ours by sending us an email, to crime at AtoZHistoryPage.com. All of this and more can be found in the show notes. We'll see you next time on Organized Crime and Punishment. Forget about it.
Text the word HISTORY using the code 30605 and we'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. Jeff in Indiana lost 55 pounds with Calitrin. Lily in Tennessee shed 42 pounds. Beth is sleeping much better and her joint aches have eased up considerably. Text the word HISTORY to the code 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an amazing 86% success rate with their 90-day supply. And this week, take advantage of our special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is so easy. Just text the word HISTORY, that's HISTORY, using the code 30605. And we'll send you a link to this special offer.